It's Thursday, January 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, North Korea claims to have detonated a hydrogen bomb.
The whole thing, you know, can say very clearly now that he's now being held in mainland China. But for what reason, that we have no idea.
It's not a mystery novel. Five Hong Kong booksellers are missing. Also ahead, intense weather brings intense debate on its cause. And the newest electronic gadgets are on the way and are all on today's International Edition. North Korea's claim Wednesday of another successful nuclear detonation, its first hydrogen test, has drawn international condemnation, including from its neighbor and closest ally, China. The Chinese Foreign Ministry said it firmly opposes such a test, will lodge a protest, and did not know in advance that it was coming. Britain says it has joined China in calling for a resumption of six-party talks aimed at the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. The White House has promised to study the nature of the apparent test and respond appropriately. An emergency meeting of the UN Security Council has been held. It has already imposed a series of sanctions on the North over its previous atomic and missile tests. The seismic strength of the test was initially set at 5.1 magnitude on the Richter scale. RAND Corporation nuclear analyst Bruce Bennett told VOA's Victor Beatty he's doubtful it was a hydrogen bomb blast as claimed by the North.
Their third nuclear test, which most people think was in the range of about 6 to 10 kilotons or smaller than the Hiroshima blast, was a 4.9 on the Richter scale. This one is reported as a 5.1. That number might get adjusted, but given the scale is logarithmic, that means this one was about 1.5 times as powerful as the last one. So it takes it barely up to the level of the Hiroshima blast, roughly speaking. That's not too impressive for a fourth nuclear test. Most countries who get to a fourth test do considerably better than that. And if this is a hydrogen bomb, should have been somewhere between 10 and 100 times as big.
So they're hyping it, in your view?
They're clearly hyping it. Now, one possibility is that it could be what is called a boosted weapon. In a boosted weapon, which is an early generation of working with fusion, the hydrogen bomb material, you only add a little bit of fusion material to the bomb, and it makes it more efficient. And so they could have been trying to do that, but even if they were trying to do that, they should have been at least 5 to 10 times bigger than their last test, and they're not. So either their fusion element failed or their fission element acted really poorly, like back along the lines of the first or second test, for them to come out in the kind of size range we're hearing, unless that gets adjusted.
Sung-Yoon Lee, a Korea expert at Tufts University, views the latest test as an effort to squeeze more concessions out of the global community.
We know North Korea has a propensity to resort to these things, major provocations. In the first half of the calendar year, raising the stakes, then in the second half of the calendar year, launching sort of a peace offensive with a view towards reaping concessions just for de-escalation and creating the illusion of crisis averted. And North Korea has been very good at playing this game over the past 25 years. It's reaped, by my calculation, at least $20 billion from China, South Korea, and the United States. This is a particularly opportune time because North Korea likely calculates that this decades-old cycle of provocations, negotiations, extorting concessions that has brought it billions of dollars will work once again against democratically elected leaders who come and go with each election cycle, especially those nearing the end of their term.
What will South Korea's response likely be?
Usually there's a lot of rhetorical condemnation. This is unacceptable. this is an unacceptable provocation, this is provocative, there will be penalties, there will be some action at the UN Security Council. So far, there have been 5 or 6 strongly worded UN Security Council resolutions with a view toward penalizing North Korea for its provocations, long-range missile tests and nuclear tests. Those are effective, those are helpful. But they have not deterred North Korea's march toward nuclear breakout, because while China signs on to those UN Security Council sanctions, China behind the scenes has gradually increased its aid to North Korea.
Sung-Yoon Lee says he is bewildered by targeted financial sanctions, which have proven to be effective to change North Korean behavior in the past and that have not yet been reimposed by the United States. We turn now to our social media segment. As you might imagine, the online community is talking about yet another news surrounding the North's nuclear test. And International Edition's G. Abby Lee is right here in Studio 22 with me to tell us the latest. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. The breaking news is that the U.S. government, just like Bennett, is questioning Pyongyang's claims about the hydrogen bomb test. As you know, North Korea on Wednesday reported its 4th nuclear test and claimed it was a hydrogen bomb. But it turns out that claim may not be true.
Well, North Korea exaggerating its nuclear capabilities is not new. What's the response like on the internet?
For that, let's check out a New York Times article. The NYT was one of the first media outlets to break the news, and it shared a link to the article on its Facebook page. The Facebook post reads like this. The White House says the initial data from its monitoring stations in Asia were not consistent with North Korea's claim that the nuclear test was its first test of a hydrogen bomb.
Well, that's a pretty big statement. Tell us about some of the comments to the article.
Sure. One of the comments highlighted by the NYT is by a reader in Pennsylvania, and it reads like this. I do not understand why our leaders in government have been so focused on Iran's potential to develop a nuclear bomb when North Korea, a completely rogue nation run by a madman, already has it. Another reader based in Texas wrote this. If I had the U.S., the only country ever to use a nuclear weapon, I'm threatening their further use, and with the world's largest arsenal of such weapons glaring at me since 1949, I too would arm myself with an H-bomb. Who wouldn't? Other comments include criticizing the fact that the Kim Jong-un regime could have been better used the money used in developing the weapons by spending it on feeding its people. Jim?
Well, from national security to food security, thanks for bringing us these diverse responses, G. And you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee, or on our program's account, that's at VOA_IE. I'm out there as well, at VOA Stevenson. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. 5 booksellers have mysteriously disappeared in Hong Kong, and that has created much concern there. The most recent is 65-year-old Li Bo, who is a dual Chinese and British citizen. His wife withdrew his missing persons report just on Monday, saying that he went to the mainland voluntarily. The bookshop at the center of the controversy is known to sell sometimes scandalous publications about China's Communist Party leadership. International Edition host Sarah Williams explores the disappearances with Patrick Poon, a China researcher for Amnesty International in Hong Kong.
According to what the alleged letter he sent to his office in Hong Kong, and his wife also disclosed that letter to the public, he also said in the letter that he is assisting an investigation. So the whole thing, you know, can say very clearly now that he's now being held in mainland China. But for what reason, that we have no idea. And there are rumors about whether there's a new book they're going to publish about Xi Jinping and his bluffers. And there's no way to confirm whether it's true or not, because what we see is so far is only the Hong Kong government leaders. They say they're investigating the case. But the problem is that we haven't heard of any official comment from the Chinese government. And this doesn't seem to be the Chinese government want to admit any responsibility for holding this person. And if only the party mouthpiece Global Times been talking about his case, and also the bookstore been like selling the books, discrediting the bookstore, publishing those books of affecting, you know, infringing the mainland leaders, mainland government leaders' credibility. But then, like, there's no further information whatsoever about these five people. And it's very worrying whether, you know, it would set a very bad situation here in Hong Kong about whether freedom of press, freedom of publication, and freedom of expression would be affected.
Isn't, you know, Hong Kong known for publishing books that have been banned in the mainland?
Yes, those books are quite popular. I mean, like, especially for, like, for the mainland tourists, they travel to Hong Kong. Many of them would buy those books, those banned books. And actually, those books, ranging from, you know, rumors about mainland officials, leaders, or about their biography, or some of, like, unknown personal stories of those mainland leaders, which are actually banned on the mainland, because if they want to publish those books, Hong Kong seems to be the only place on Chinese soil which can sell those books.
Well, the idea, though, that people who, you know, people in Hong Kong can somehow be disappeared, that must be very troubling, though, I would think, even for the Hong Kong government.
I mean, like, so far what the Hong Kong government, especially the chief executive said so far, just repeating what is enshrined in the Hong Kong Basic Law, which ensure Hong Kong citizens have rights to freedom of expression, freedom of publication.
Patrick Poon with Amnesty International. A series of weather disasters has shaken the world in recent weeks, with deadly floods in the United States and Britain adding to ongoing devastating droughts in Brazil, South Africa, and India. VOA's Michael Lippin examined the causes of the extreme weather with a panel of climate observers in this week's hashtag VOA TV program. And he joins us now right here in the studio.
Hi, Jen.
Hi, Michael. How did the panelists explain what's going on?
Well, you know, we talked about two major climate phenomena, one being global warming, which has been going on for years, as I'm sure you know, and the other is El Nino, which is a natural periodic warming of the eastern Pacific Ocean that can last a year or two. Now, the latest El Nino started a few months ago, and it's proved to be particularly strong this year. One of the panelists in the show was Jeff Masters. He's the director of meteorology at Weather Underground, which is a U.S. online news service. He joined us via Skype and said that rising temperatures linked to global warming and El Nino could be to blame for freak disasters like those floods you mentioned in the American Midwest and northern Britain.
We have to understand that if you've got a warmer planet with warmer oceans, you're going to get a lot more evaporation off those oceans. So now with a warmer atmosphere, you've got more energy to power bigger storms. So when it does rain, you're going to see more of those high-end societal impactful events.
Now, another panelist in the show was Robert Finney. He's the author of robertscribbler.com. That's a popular U.S. blog about environmental issues. I asked Finney about another highly unusual weather event from last month, which was the temperature at the North Pole briefly rising above freezing in the middle of winter. Finney said the Arctic heat wave is melting sea ice and creating a feedback effect.
The loss of sea ice turns a white reflective surface to a dark heat-absorbing surface. And so during the summertime, the Arctic Ocean is sucking up a lot more heat from the solar rays. And over time, it re-radiates that heat over the fall and into the winter. And that's a really big impact. That's a new impact that we're seeing.
Well, you know, the Arctic's polar bears rely on that shrinking ice to live, hunt, and breed. And Polar Bears International, a U.S. and Canadian nonprofit dedicated to conserving the animals, says their numbers are dropping. The group's chief scientist, Stephen Amstrup, who also spoke to us via Skype, said he expects more of the animals to disappear even if the international community limits global warming to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, as agreed to in last month's Paris Climate Conference.
The impacts would be significant, and we would lose polar bears over much of their current range. But it's a lot more than polar bears. People say, well, polar bears live way up north, and why should I care? They're just really harbingers of what's coming to the rest of us.
And what the climate observers say is coming to the rest of us in 2016 could be more human losses to extreme weather as global warming and El Nino continue to fuel each other in the coming months. Jim?
Quite a bit to think about. Thank you so much, Michael.
Sure.
Michael Lippin, check him out on hashtag VOA. You can see it at our website, voanews.com, and possibly a TV station near you. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sagan, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
The 2016 Consumer Electronics Show is this week in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hop a plane if you can. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, virtual reality technology, robotics, super high definition televisions, and automotive concepts are on the agenda.
This year's Consumer Electronics Show is expected to highlight more of the Internet of Things, with devices and delivery systems taking center stage. Robin Raskin is the founder of Living in Digital Times. She says that the sprawling display of electronics shows that what was once fantasy is becoming reality.
Just from a year ago, it's like all the building block pieces have come together towards artificial intelligence, robotics, drones, driverless cars. That was all like sort of science fiction hype just a year ago at CES. Virtual reality, and this year it's all real. It's somewhat terrifying, but really exhilarating also.
One time, virtual reality was for gaming only, but now designers and manufacturers have used 360-degree cameras to give viewers a truly immersive real-life experience. Henry Stewart is the co-founder of Visualize, a London-based company that gives users views of events they could not have imagined just last year.
And we capture that by using 360-degree cameras that are essentially balls of cameras, different kinds of cameras for different jobs. And these all capture video at once. We then synchronize the cameras, stitch and blend all the content, and produce a sphere, which you can then put into virtual reality in a virtual reality headset and immerse yourself in it and look around.
Stewart's company has produced videos that feature a rock band in concert, a passenger's eye view of a Lamborghini driving the coast of Italy, and what it's like from the outside of London's building, The Shard.
And so you've got this 36-hour time-lapse looking over London, seeing the clouds rush in, seeing the weather change, seeing the day and the night cycle, and it's really stunning. And so for The Shard, it means that they can go to tourism expos around the world and encourage tourism, you know, to visit and see this incredible view for yourself.
Robots are expected to make a big splash at this year's CES as well. In the past, many of the robots have been more toy-like, but Robin Raskin says designers are rolling out concepts for robots that are more like personal assistants.
And I'm thinking of an aging population saying, go get that bottle or open this jar for me or can you help me take my blood pressure? So you're going to see really useful robots, physician's assistant robots, articulating arms, manufacturing. So the practical uses of robotics as well as the entertaining ones.
And auto lovers can look for the latest in automotive technology this week, including more advances toward driverless or autonomous cars. Faraday Future made a splash with its concept car, the FF01, which utilizes the company's variable platform architecture, the same undercarriage and batteries that can be modified for a variety of vehicles, from a race car to an SUV. Nick Sampson is Faraday's Senior Vice President of Research and Development and Product Development.
Over the past 18 months, we've assembled an extraordinary group of over 550 talented individuals in California, plus 200 more globally. We're working literally night and day to reimagine, rethink, and create an entirely new concept for mobility.
The 2016 Consumer Electronics Show runs through January 9th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And with any luck, International Edition will run well beyond that. You can find us always at voanews.com. That's our website. We're available any time of the day or night for you. We're also out there on Twitter. Please follow us at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, and our engineer is Keith Holmes. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all here in Washington. Thanks for joining us. We hope you come back and visit, and have a great day. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, is awarding more than $8.4 million in grants and cooperative agreements this year to support conservation projects and scientific studies that benefit coral reef management across seven U.S. states and territories, the Caribbean and Micronesia. All of these projects focus on priority coral reef regions and watersheds, addressing three primary threats: global climate change, land-based sources of pollution, and unsustainable fishing practices. Funded projects include grants to reduce sediment and improve water quality in U.S. Virgin Islands, work with communities in Hawaii to address threats to coral reefs, support coral reef ecosystem conservation in Puerto Rico, and strengthen outreach and education efforts. Projects also include work to assess coral reef resiliency to climate change in multiple locations. Earlier this year, NOAA declared the third global coral bleaching event. While corals can recover from mild bleaching, severe or long-term bleaching is often lethal, especially when combined with other threats. Healthy coral reefs are important to all of us. Conservation of these resources is a key factor in the resilience of coastal communities, said Jennifer Koss, director of the NOAA Coral Reef Conservation Program. The projects funded through NOAA's grants program allow us to strengthen our ties with local partners, address the most pressing threats to corals, and broaden our conservation efforts. Nearly half of the funds awarded this year directly support coral reef conservation projects led by state and territorial resource management agencies. Other conservation projects are led by non-governmental organizations, community groups, and academic partners. A limited number of international projects focused in Micronesia, Mesoamerica, and the wider Caribbean region were also supported. It's exciting to fund smart and innovative projects led by partners who are working across disciplines to make a positive impact on the condition of the world's coral reefs, said Jenny Waddell, coordinator of the NOAA Coral Reef Conservation Program's grants portfolio. There are surely a lot of challenges ahead for coral reefs, but by studying, managing, and conserving them in a collaborative way, we are all helping to ensure coral reefs continue to survive and thrive.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.